chance of showers in the afternoon.
And ladies and gentlemen, we are back. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It is 11:06 here in Central France. Great to have you with me here. Freezing cold outside, weather report, but clear, unbelievably clear. Beautiful sky tonight. Going to be very, very cold early in the morning, I'm sure. But that's just been happening all over here in Europe. I mean, we've had some temperatures that have just been frightening. I mean, really, really frightening. In fact, in Russia, they had 96 below zero Fahrenheit in Siberia. Can you imagine that? Anyway, we've been talking with Eustace Mullins here, and Eustace is, everyone that's been studying the subjects that I've been talking about for some time on my site, has to defer to much of the work that Eustace has put together over time and his relationship to the people who also fought the fight with him. What we're doing today is discussing some of those people from the past that are no longer with us and getting Eustace's take on their efforts and the things that they put together, as well as some of the bad guys that he faced at that time. One of the people that you worked with, Eustace, in your early years was Joseph McCarthy. And Joe McCarthy he was on to the truth, wasn't he? And boy, did they lambaste him toward the middle part of his effort to expose these people.
Well, that's absolutely true. You see, Washington had become a place where everybody knew what was going on, but nobody talked about it. And everybody accepted that situation until Joe came along as a Wisconsin farm boy from upstate Wisconsin. And Joe was horrified by what was going on in Washington. He started talking about it.
Well, I mean, what led him to this nest? Where did he get his information from when Joe was doing his research?
Well, when Joe came to Washington, he was a farm boy. And so he was picked up by the insiders. And his three mentors became J. Edgar Hoover, Father Walsh of the Georgetown Foreign School of Service, and George Sikorsky, a Russian communist Bolshevik from Vladivostok.
Now, those were his mentors.
Those were his mentors. Joe didn't know a thing about anything, and they told him what they wanted to hear. And they created his anti-communist crusade out of nothing.
They did. They wanted the crusade to take place.
Absolutely.
Why?
Because it was focusing on little Jewish shoemakers and people like that, and it totally ignoring the world banking forces behind these dictatorships like Germany and Italy and so forth.
So they threw some low-level Jews to the dogs and to kind of dissipate the vitriol and the anger against what they were doing.
Oh, definitely. And so the first couple of years that Joe was in Washington, that's all he knew, was what Sikorsky and Jared Groover told him.
Wow. And so, and then he was set up to be taken down.
Not quite that fast. See, a friend of mine was working for him, George Westinghouse Kiles, and we were good friends. We had lunch together on Capitol Hill every day. So Kiles told me that he said, "Would you do some work for Joe McCarthy?" And I said, "Well, what would he want me to do?" He said, "He would just like for you to do a little research for him." So I went to the Library of Congress and prepared a 40-page report giving the entire financial background of world communism, which was anti-capitalist, by the way. I mean, their so-called philosophy was anti-capitalist. Well, it was all bankers' money. And so this 40-page report that I prepared for Joe told the entire background of world communism. As Wall Street bankers and Swiss bankers and London bankers, and that was it. There was never a working class person associated with the communist movement. So Kyle took that to Joe, and he was really excited about it. It opened the world up to him for the first time in his life. So he took that speech and flew to Chicago and gave a speech at the Union Club, the top people in Chicago, and they went wild. And so he came back. He was on top of the world. And he had a lot of support. He was getting 25,000 letters a day from the American people. They were so gratified that at last somebody had told them what communism was.
Mm-hmm.
So he was overnight the most popular politician in American history, and it looked like he was going to take over the whole town single-handed, and they were scared. I mean, they were terrified. So that's when they started working on him, and they got a counterpart composed of Richard Nixon and Senator Cabot from Washington, from Massachusetts.
Henry Cabot Lodge?
Henry Cabot Lodge. The Lodge family and the and Richard Nixon and a couple other insiders, and they plotted Joe's downfall. They created this fake reprimand, which destroyed Joe completely. And what they accused him of was criticizing Democrats. That was the offense for which Joe was driven out of Washington.
Criticizing Democrats. Not for criticizing communism, like they say today.
No, no. He was not really criticizing communism that much, but because he knew the background of communism, as the first person in Washington who had ever heard the true background of communism. And it blew his mind. Well, when Ezra Pound told me about it in insane asylum in 1948, it blew my mind.
Ezra put who in the insane asylum? Ezra was in the insane asylum.
Yeah, you see, they accused him of treason, but they couldn't. They had no basis for that charge, so they couldn't try him. So they said he's incompetent to participate in his own defense, and they had three government psychiatrists commit him to St. Elizabeth's.
And see, how long did they keep him there?
They kept him about 13 and a half years, but he was supposed to spend the rest of his life there because people on Capitol Hill swore that Joe would die. I mean, Ezra Pound would die in St. Elizabeth. He'd never be freed during his lifetime. And when I met Pound, he told me, he said, I want the government to drop the charges and I'll walk out a free man. And I really thought he was crazy then because there was no chance of that. But 10 years later, he walked out a free man.
Wow. So they're willing to do whatever it takes to protect themselves from being exposed.
Absolutely. When they go after an enemy, they'll destroy you by any means that they can. And if one thing doesn't work, they'll try something else. And money is no object.
I'm beginning to experience this now.
I've been up against it for 60 years. I know what it's like, and they do.
They'll spend
thousands of dollars for agents to infiltrate you and destroy your operation.
Well, my operation is me, so what are they going to do to infiltrate me other than to try to destroy me from outside? And truth is they're spinning like lie after lie, and they're coming from all kinds of different places, including people that most people would never think would do that.
Oh, yeah.
That's the oddest thing, Eustace. They're coming from places you don't believe that they would ever come from.
Well, that shows that they're desperate, you see. They're going to keep on. When they're desperate, they try harder than ever. I'm not offering you a very good prospect there.
No, that doesn't sound like a solution there, Eustace. You know, here, I want to go on to another fellow here that's very instrumental in this because he never did turn sides. He was always on the bad guy side. His name is Untermyer.
Oh, Sammy Untermyer, yeah.
Yeah, and he was as tied into this as you can get. And he did a 1933 speech, boy, that I've got the transcript on my website here. It is very powerful in the way he uses the lie of the day to explain to his constituency within the Jewish Zionist community. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask Eustace about this gentleman, Untermyer, this guy, this crazy man here, and see what we can't put together about him when we return on The French Connection. Gentlemen, we are back with our special guest today, Eustace Mullins. Eustace is he's a real resource, and he's a first-person witness to much of what we're discussing today, and the names and times of early on in this fight against world Zionism. It's been around for hundreds of years in its present manifestations, but it has its roots over the millennia almost. I mean, these folks have been fermenting problems dating back to as far back as the Spanish Inquisition and before, haven't they?
Oh, yes, indeed. There's nothing new here because their plans have never changed over the centuries. They remained consistent and committed to their plans, and they're going to go ahead with them regardless of anything.
Boy, you know, now how does Mr. Untermyer figure into all these activities?
Well, he was a key financial and lawyer to the big bankers in New York City. He put together deals for Bernard Baruch and the Rothschilds. He merged some of the biggest companies in the United States. And he charged enormous fees, $2 or $3 billion a fee. And he became a multimillionaire many times over. He lived like a king. He had 60 gardeners at his estate outside of New York City.
Jesus. Well, he comes back from his European visit in 33, announcing to the Jewish group that was, the Zionist group that was meeting that day, that he was successful in beginning the destruction of the German people. And that he was working on that boycott of their products, and
yes.
Boy, he was venomous about what he wanted them to do.
Oh, he really was. He was a venomous person, and that was a declaration of war against Germany in 1933. So World War II was actually inaugurated by Samuel Untermyer in New York in 1933.
Yeah, that was the day that that the war was actually declared, wasn't it, against the German people?
That was war, and that was a declaration of war.
Now, the fact that Hitler was stupid enough, or did he know, that he was making a deal with Stalin not to have a non-aggression pact and then turned around and went against that, why? They were both being supported by the same group. Stalin had his Zionist money supporters, and so did Hitler.
Well, because anybody that these people support, they support you in a given territory, but you cannot encroach on somebody else's territory. You see, when Hitler invaded Russia in June 1941, it was to stop Stalin from invading Germany in 1941, because Stalin had already committed all of his troops to attack Germany in September of 1941.
So Barbarossa was a plan to beat Stalin to the attack.
That's right. It was a blitzkrieg, which was intended to be launched before Stalin hit him. It was rival gangs fighting over the same territory.
And both of them being financed, again, two sides of a war being financed by the same megalomaniacs.
Oh, yes. Well, you cannot really have a war unless you finance both sides, because it's very hard to start wars. Most people don't want to go to war. And therefore, you have to finance two sides to get them to fight each other.
Is that happening in Iraq right now?
Oh, certainly. We were dealing with Iraq all along. You know, Saddam Hussein was on the CIA payroll for 40 years, and the Bushes supported him all the way.
Now, who's in charge of America right now? I know George Bush and family are just underlings of these people.
Oh, yeah, they're lackeys. I used to tell people that the Rothschilds financed the Harrimans and the Union Pacific Railroad, and they financed John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. So they were just puppets of the Rothschilds.
And they're not even way up on the food chain, are they?
Oh, no. In fact, I don't think they participate in the important councils at all. They just do what they're told.
Uh-huh. And who are some of the others that are doing it today in our country?
Well, it's the old families. You know, there's five Italian families that have controlled the papacy since 1825. It was the Medici and three or four other families. They're well-known in Italy.
But who's in control of the United States right now, Eustace?
Well, when you look at it, it almost looks like nobody is in control. The American people certainly are in control. They're totally out of control.
Well, but I mean, what families right now are controlling the strings?
Well, it's right out of Europe and the Rothschilds. But the families they're using here are the Schiffs and the Warburgs and the Rockefellers and people like that.
And how about the Goldmans and the Lehmans and the Kahn? And
well, they're all Wall Street stooges, that's all they are. They're just brokers on worlds on Wall Street. They don't have any real power. They make a lot of money. They make $100 billion a year apiece, but they don't really have any power. No, the decisions are made from higher up.
And really the higher up is between Warburg and Rothschild.
Oh, that's exactly right. You're talking business now.
And those families intermarry, don't they?
They do. They intermarry constantly. And in fact, they are more conscious of marriages than the royal families of Europe. Any marriage between members of those families is a business merger. That's all it is.
Really? And who is the lead component of that family today?
The lead component?
Of the Rothschild fortune. Is it the British part of it?
The British who?
There are three parts of the family. Some of them live in Zurich, some live in London, and some live in France.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're pretty well evenly matched. For quite a few years, 1920 to 1940, the Rothschilds were financed by the British and were controlled by the French branch. But they're out of power now. They were controlled after that by the London branch. I think it's still being run out of London.
And is that the same guy that this Edward there that you see pictures of Governor Schwarzenegger there standing beside and Warren Buffett taking pictures with? Is that the guy that's in charge?
For a long time there was a guy named Goldsmith, Jimmy Goldsmith, but he died, and I don't know exactly who's running the show right now.
Well, it seems to me all the intermarriage would start affecting their intellect. Is that happening?
Well, it probably does, and it probably has. They don't particularly show any intellect. They're just doing the same thing over and over again. They're not coming out with anything new. And that's why they're so predictable.
But how the heck do they get away with it so cleverly? I mean, how do they do it?
Well,
How come the public can't get their brains around this problem?
Because they've got control of capital, and they've got control of the seats of power. And the public cannot get their foot in the door.
Have we ever had our foot in the door, ever?
Well, we've had our foot in the door a couple of times. We had them with Andrew Jackson, and we had them with people like Thomas Jefferson. There's been people who turned up sometime that did some good. Now, Ezra Pound used to tell me that the last decent American president was Calvin Coolidge. He was a New England boy who became president. He was a very good president. But since then, it's all been downhill.
Oh, boy. Well, when we come back, we're going to have one more segment with Eustace, and we're going to discuss a couple of extra things that we have on our minds here today on The French Connection. When we return, more from Eustace Mullen.
Baby, do I feel high? Oh, me, oh, my.
And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to smooth our way right into this next long segment and then let my good friend Eustace Mullins go for his rest of his day in peace. Eustace, I want to talk to you about where we are in this fight and are we getting traction? I mean, I understand from my efforts that they are very worried about what I'm doing. There are many others waking up. I can tell you before I started fighting this particular part of the battle with Eric Hufschmidt, very few people could get away with talking about this without being completely mobbed by the ADL and the JDO.
Oh, that's true.
Now, we're actually getting traction, and more people are springing up everywhere, speaking about it. Almost unopposed. Is that bizarre?
That's not bizarre. It's inevitable. They've been getting away with murder for years. They've been covering up all this criminal activity and hoodwinking the American people who are portrayed absolutely been bamboozled into going like pack dogs after anybody that the Zionists want to sick along. And I went through that over the last 60 years. You're going through it. But what happened was the Internet. And there's stuff coming out every day on the Internet that's really turning the world around.
And you think this is going to be their undoing, is the Internet?
Oh, it certainly is, because people are finding an outlet there, and they're deserting the media. They won't look at television. And I know people in Phoenix, Arizona, and Atlanta, Georgia, spend all day doing email, corresponding with people. There's just a heck of a lot going on.
There is, isn't there?
Oh, there is.
Well, you know, they can shut the Internet down. What would that do to this movement? To communist Russia and make it live behind closed walls like they did for China as well.
Well,
I mean,
that is exactly what they're doing.
Are they going to get away with it?
No, they won't get away with it because people still have some desire to live. They don't. They're not all afflicted with the death wish. And people have been asking me at my lectures for 40 years, they say, when is the crash coming? When is the crash coming? Because they've been mind conditioned to expect a crash.
Mm-hmm.
And so they prepare them for the crash. Whenever they ask me when the crash is coming, I'd say as soon as the government stops printing counterfeit money. Because this government, this economy, functions entirely on counterfeit money, and that's all that keeps it going from day to day. And without the counterfeit money, it would all crash tomorrow.
Well, what happens if the trading partners, such as China, no longer buy the treasury bills that they're printing for $3 billion a day to finance their future debt? What happens if they say, no, we don't think that that's a very good purchase? What will happen?
Well, nobody is independent. These things are all controlled. China is just as controlled as the United States. So they'll keep on doing it as long as they're told to.
Do you think there is a goal that they will implode the place intentionally?
I don't know. If a racket is paying off, why would you close it down?
Hmm. So you're not predicting that they're going to try to implode the economy?
Not at all, because it's one thing to fix a horse race, but you don't go down and shoot all the horses. That doesn't solve anything.
Well, I see most of the businesses of any substance moving out of the country.
Oh, yeah.
I see most of the American public incapable today of holding any technical jobs because their education system has been so destroyed. And I don't see that the American economy is a place where anybody really feels comfortable making money anymore. It seems like they're gutting it, like they're destroying it from within.
Well, it's been gutted. It's been destroyed. I just came back from a month in Ohio, right in the heart of the Rust Belt at Toledo and Detroit. And what's going on is horrible. It's like the Depression in 1932.
Well, then why would you say that this is not an implosion intentionally?
It's an intentional explosion. But I think the American people will survive it. I think they have the will to survive. They don't know what's happening, but they're still not going to take it lying down.
Well, what would you suggest I do to get this message out farther afield, Eustace?
What you're doing is doing it. If you get the message out at all, you're winning. And if you're letting people know what's going on, I lectured for years to crowds, as little as six or eight people, but I started a lot of fires that way, and those people today are still doing what they can to get this thing solved.
Well, I'm doing it because I woke up to the fact that I saw what our future was, and, well, worse than that, Eustace, I woke up finding out that everything I believed in was a lie.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a starting place for everybody. You realize it's all lies, and you got to start looking for the truth.
And, boy, it's been a long, hard journey.
Oh, it's tough. I've been to the roof. When you start looking for the truth, the roof falls on you and on you. But if you survive that, you can keep going.
Well, you know, you would hope so until all the dogs are called out on you, Eustace, and you start getting worried and they pick through your rubbish can and stuff, you know?
Oh, yes. They know how to give you the full treatment.
Well, yeah, you know, I figured if they're looking through my rubbish, they're not ready to do me in. What they're willing to do is probably try to find ways to destroy me with what they find in my trash, I guess. I don't know.
Well, they use anything they can, and they don't quit either. That's the thing about it. They won't quit.
Well, I guess then I can't quit either.
You can't because they force you to fight whether you want to fight or not.
Well, Eustace, do you have any suggestions for my listeners and what you would get them to get motivated to fight this further?
Well, you know, we're on the verge of a revolution right now. This country is about to have the biggest waking up since 1776, and it's going to come whether you want it or try to stop it or anything else, and it's on its way. America has always been the greatest country in the world, and it's amazing that the American people have survived all of the misery and lies and everything that they've been inundated with since 1900, but they're still going. The American people are still sound. It's an amazing situation.
So you're very hopeful then?
I'm very optimistic.
Well, good.
And that, even being up at the Rust Belt in Ohio and in Michigan, which is a very depressing thing, it looks like a crash of 29 all over again.
Well, that's not very different than some parts of Massachusetts. If you go to Leominster and Lowell.
Terrible, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is happening throughout the nation, and, you know. Well, Eustace, I'm so happy you came on today. I didn't get to everything I wanted to ask you, but, you know, this is just one visit.
Oh, it is, but, you know, you never can cover everything. After every program I do, I think the 50 things that I should have said.
Well, I'll have you back, sir, if you'll be willing to come.
Well, I'm right here.
Well, sir, I thank you again, and I will be in touch with you. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, after this break with some closing things. And, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. We're back, we're back. Let's talk a little bit about what else Mr. Myron Fagan spoke about here. It says, World War III is to be fomented using the so-called controversies by the agents of the Illuminati operating under whatever name that they are now being stored up between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Muslim world. The war is to be directed in such a manner that all of Islam and political Zionism will destroy each other, while at the same time remaining nations, once more divided in this issue, will be forced to fight themselves to a state of complete exhaustion, physical, mental, and spiritual, and economically. Well, I'm wondering to myself if that statement is not perfectly accurate. And I'm wondering also why, because this was in the early 60s, and what I do know about these people is that political reality on the ground often shifts the way they do their battling. It looks like instead of between Zionism and Muslims, the war that they've been fermenting has been between Christians and Muslims. That seems to be more about what they're doing. Now, it seems like Israel's trying to stay out of it and the Jewish group that is involved. But as Eustace pointed out, these people are not terribly interested in his view of religion. They're more interested in power and control, and they want world domination, and that has been his experience for 60 years of doing this. Now, I kind of believe that that's probably true, although they do use this religious divide and these differences that people have in their faiths as ways of setting us up to be opponents to one another and working this double-sided paradigm continuously, as they did in Northern Ireland against Catholics and Protestants, as they're doing now between Shia and Sunni, between Democrat and Republican, between black and white, between every single kind of group that can be opposed to another. And you'll often find that these people are behind them in preparation for the next battle. For example, environmentalists against, people who are capitalists. There's always a yin and yang battle being thrown at us so that we will never discuss the real power structure behind these groups. And it seems to me that we're starting to become sophisticated enough to see through this. At least many of the people who've been studying this see through it. How do we make political capital ourselves on the fact that we do understand these political fights are nothing more than fabrications, and they're there to separate us from one another in order not that we won't fight the real villains in this battle? Of course, they have massive amounts of capital to employ against us. It's not too hard to find people willing to do things for money, sadly. Some people believe in do things to get a book published. And, you know, when you see these kinds of behaviors, it makes it very, very difficult to understand how we're going to be able to coalesce around a single body, a single truth of these bad guys doing this. And look, we've often talked about the New World Order, the globalists, the da-da-da. But when you get to the top of the pyramid, this is what Eric and I have been trying to get people to focus on. At the top of all these disparate groups are these enormously, beyond anything you can wrap your brain around, rich bankers of Warburg, Rothschild, and several other families that I tried to get Eustace to be more specific about. But Friday's show will bring some specificity to some of these other claims, and it'll give us an opportunity, I think, to maybe codify further the people that we are discussing in this battle. Because, look, this is a huge conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen. One of the reasons why it's so hard for people to even acquiesce to its existence and its truth is because it is so large and it has gone on so long. And so many people say, well, geez, I would have heard about this years ago if it were true. Well, no, usually the biggest lies are the ones that get passed on. Smaller ones get caught because people are out looking for them. But the ones that sit over us like a horizon are often so large that we don't even notice them. And this is the kind of thing this is. You know, whether I'm living in this country or in America or Germany or anywhere else on this globe, these folks are in charge. And whether I've got a socialist claimed leadership in this country, or I have Gaullist claimed leadership, or I have Republican or Democrat like in America, or Tory and Labor, the two sides of every one of these organizations is always controlled by the same group in at the top of the pyramid. And of course, it's interesting to note that they use Satanism as a rallying cry for some of this stuff. And as far as I've been able to glean, it's only the lower level people that display this in any large way. The people who are really controlling things don't seem to be displaying it quite as much. Now, whether that's just my take on it, maybe on Friday we can bring that up as well. Ladies and gentlemen, when we return, we're going to close out the show here today, The French Connection. I appreciate you all listening. Stick with me. We have one more segment to go and lots more to talk about. And ladies and gentlemen, we're back. We're going to end up this show today with a couple of more things that I'm reading here about this Mr. Fagan's work here. It's extensive. It goes on for a long, long time. You can actually listen to it or you can read it yourself. I prefer to actually read some of these things so I can go over them a couple of times. But it talks about the Federal Reserve Act. It talks about how Kennedy actually tried in his first administration to actually undo some of his learning, because Joseph Kennedy, the father, was certainly involved in some of these machinations of this group. But John Kennedy actually filed for and got the government to start issuing federal notes, which was a direct threat to the Federal Reserve, which was how these bankers used to control the nation. And, of course, according to this man that we're reading about here, Mr. Myron Fagan, he was killed for it. And interestingly enough, the first act on the flight back to Washington that Johnson committed after becoming president was to reverse that federal note decision of John Kennedy. So apparently he was angered. The Zionists were angered by Mr. Kennedy's actions, and the result, of course, was his murder. And, you know, you might well make the connection that Mr. Herbert Walker Bush, having been part of a conspiracy from as early as the 1960s, probably took a great role in that activity in Dallas and has ever since. There are pictures, actually, of him having been there that day, and there is a direct evidence he was involved. So maybe he proved himself to be very helpful early on, and his grandfather, having worked with Harriman, probably put him in a good position to be a favored person in these in the next machinations, which took place, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, under the nose of the American people, but we all know that Lee Harvey Oswald was not responsible for the murder of President Kennedy, and nor was Sirhan Sirhan the responsible party for Robert's death. And we go on and on. I mean, you know, these people are under drug-induced, hypnotic-induced mind control. They're Manchurian candidates, ladies and gentlemen, and they acted out of some kind of sick programming that had been thrown onto them, and they were victimized and took the blame for acts that were political and about world domination of this particular group. Now, I'm wondering what's going to happen when this full story begins to be embraced. We need more people to read these documents, to look at them and understand they are first-person accounts of people who were there. You just had someone on my program who knew these men, both men that we discussed today, and he knew the Untermyer character and the way that this man's business practices were meted out. I wonder how we can get this further afield rather than, you know, we need people who are serious about this this scholarship to start passing this as far and as widely as they can, ladies and gentlemen. So please heed this one. I mean, we need to do this. It's desperate. Take it to upon yourself to do it as you wish. This is Daryl Bradford Smith. Tomorrow we'll have another great guest, so stick with me. We'll be back with more French Connection tomorrow.